I, the preacher, have been king over Israel in Jerusalem, and applied my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. It is an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. I've seen everything that is done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and a striving after wind. What is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be counted. I said in my heart, I have acquired great wisdom, surpassing all who were over Jerusalem before me. And my heart has had great experience of wisdom and knowledge, and I applied my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceive that this also is but a striving after wind, for in much wisdom is much vexation, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure, enjoy yourself. But behold, this also was vanity. I said of laughter, it is mad, and of pleasure, what use is it? I search with my heart how to cheer my body with wine, my heart still guiding me with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly, till I might see what was good for the children of man to do under heaven during the few days of their life. I made great works. I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. I made myself gardens and parks and planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made myself pools from which to water the forest of growing trees. I bought male and female slaves and had slaves who were born in my house. I had also great possessions of herds and flocks, more than any who had been before me in Jerusalem. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. I got singers, both men and women, and many concubines, the delight of the children of man. So I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also my wisdom remained with me. Whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure, for my heart found pleasure in all my toil. And this was my reward for all my toil. Then I considered all that my hands had done, and the toil I had expended in doing it, and behold, all was vanity and a striving after wind, and there was nothing to be gained under the sun. So I turned to consider wisdom and madness and folly. For what can the man do who comes after the king? Only what has already been done. Then I saw that there is more gain in wisdom than in folly, as there is more gain in light than in darkness. The wise person has his eyes in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. And yet I perceived that the same event happens to all of them. Then I said in my heart, what happens to the fool will happen to me also. Why then have I been so very wise? And I said in my heart that this also is vanity. For of the wise as of the fool there is no enduring remembrance, seeing that in the days to come all will have been long forgotten. How the wise dies just like the fool. So I hated life, because what is done under the sun was grievous to me, for all is vanity and a striving after wind. I hated all my toil in which I toil under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to the man who will come after me. And who knows whether he will be wise or a fool? Yet he will be master of all for which I toiled and used my wisdom under the sun. This also is vanity. So I turned about and gave my heart up to despair over all the toil of my labours under the sun. Because sometimes a person who has toiled with wisdom and knowledge and skill must leave everything to be enjoyed by someone who did not toil for it. This also is vanity and a great evil. What has a man from all the toil and striving of heart with which he toils beneath the sun? For all his days are full of sorrow, and his work is a vexation. Even in the night his heart does not rest. This also is vanity. There is nothing better for a person than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. This also I saw is from the hand of God. For apart from him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? For to the one who pleases him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy. But to the sinner, he has given the business of gathering and collecting, only to give to the one who pleases God. This also is vanity and a striving after wind. The booklets have got some headings for you, which will be a help to you if you look at it. I do want to say just how lovely it is to be here. It's a real joy. It feels oddly like familiar and like nothing's different, even though it has been 2 years. And I do miss Barge Fate a lot. We all do, all of us in our family do. Marcus and Fiona and Jing. We miss a lot, and also so many of you who are here, so thank you for making us welcome and having us back. And I did want to say something actually about, so we've been, those who don't know, taking a group off to Greenwich this last 2 years, and I know it has been costly and painful, especially for people pushing friends out the door and waving goodbye. And I do want to say it's a wonderful, wonderful thing when people do hard things because of the Lord, when people make sacrifices. And just to encourage you in that is the currency of the kingdom of God. And when Christians do hard things, the Lord blesses it. And so just to encourage you to keep going and being that kind of church that takes those hits and is gospel generous, so that many others benefit from your generosity. And people in Greenwich are giving, who hadn't even heard of the gospel, are rejoicing in it today because of sacrifices you've made. So do be encouraged. Now on to Ecclesiastes. My parents, so 2 days ago, I spoke to my parents on the phone. I said, we're going to do some teaching on Ecclesiastes at the weekend. And they said, oh, that sounds depressing. And I didn't want it to be personally, you know, hitting me at my deepest point, my parents saying everything I do is depressing. So I took it that they meant it was something about the book, which it was. And that is a pretty common, in fact, maybe as you were coming away on the weekend, maybe you didn't know anything about the book of Ecclesiastes, it's just a word. But for those who have perhaps heard a sermon series or read a little book or something about it, there is that's the word that crops up the most that I hear around. Oh, that's gloomy. That sounds pretty depressing. Do you know, if that is your impression of the book, my aim this 2 days, we've got four talks together, is to show you that it's not what you think it is. In fact, we have discovered this year at Grace Church, we've been... And we've been looking section by section through all the little parts of Ecclesiastes, and we have discovered that it is a wonderfully uplifting and liberating book. In fact, for some people, myself included, it has been a game changer in how we view the world. But it's liberating as a book in the kind of a way that an intervention is liberating. You may have seen situations or been involved in them where somebody is stuck in an unhealthy pattern of living, perhaps an addiction, something like that. And sometimes their friends have to confront them with some hard truths, some painful truths. And it's hard, but it's just a stage, because the ultimate aim, of course, is to lift them out of it and get them onto a better and freer way of living. And that is what I hope Ecclesiastes is going to be for us, even is we're only going to scratch the surface of it. So let's get into it. If you've got it open there in front of you, just look at the first verse of the whole book. I'm going to read the first two verses. It begins like this. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem, vanity of vanities, says the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. I think this is probably the most famous line in the book. It tops and tails the preacher's words here and in chapter 12. And the word translated vanity crops up about 30 times in total in quite a short book. And it's the big theme. And even as I did the reading, you'll have noticed it gets a lot of repetition. The Hebrew word behind it is hebel. Here it's translated vanity. Different translations do it in very different ways. And that tells you that it's quite a difficult word to translate. Some translations, the NIV, go for meaningless. Meaningless, meaningless. I think that's almost certainly mistaken, because, and we're going to see as we look at the details of the book, that the preacher does not think that life is meaningless. In fact, throughout the book, he's busy persuading us that some things are really much better than others, and because there is a God who is creator and judge, life definitely has meaning. So I don't think that's the best translation. Literally, this word hebel means mist or vapour. In fact, I packed one of those sprays that we keep under the sink, and there's one that has do not touch cleaning fluid on it, and the other one says foreplay, and I've brought the one that said foreplay and have left it in my room to spray, to show you the mist or the vapour. There you go. That's what it looks like, even if I can't squeeze the button. And as we go through this book, maybe in your mind, whenever it says vanity of vanities, just gloss it as vapour, vapour. Everything is vapour or misty, misty. Everything is mistiness. And the writer has in mind, I think, two particular ways in which life is like vapour. The first is that it's hard to grasp. It's hard, just like vapour is, you can't grab it. It's hard to understand. It just slips through your fingers. And the second way in which life is like mist is that things don't last. You know, just like morning mists, you get up in the morning, they're there, they're gone by lunchtime. Life is like that. So much in life is fleeting and vaporous. And so the big message of this book is that the preacher wants us to come to terms with the fact that life is not neat. That is to say, it's not easily understood. And also that life, things are very often fleeting and temporary, those two elements. And he wants us to have a realistic view of what the world is like and then to live humbly and wisely in the light of that fact. And his opening question here, chapter 1, verse 3, is this. What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? So he's asking there in right at the beginning of the book, does anything we do actually achieve something ultimately? And you get that idea repeated, as we're going to see. And the opening poem, which I didn't read, verses 4 to 11, we're going to skip over. That's basically pretty negative. And it says, look, if you were to get the wide angle, if you were to watch the whole of human history unfolding in fast forward beneath you, yes, the generations come and go, the empires come and go. There is apparent progress, but nothing really new or lasting is achieved. And then we come on to the section that I just read. And Solomon is carrying on with this same question. But in our section, he's bringing some new evidence to the table. And he's bringing evidence, especially from his own experience, to persuade us. Many of us will spend much of our lives effectively climbing a hill towards a goal. Perhaps there'll be different hills for each of us. Perhaps it's a goal of career advancement, the goal of family or financial security, the goal of a good reputation, whatever it is. And we keep being told, as we plod up the hill, keep going, it's tough, but keep going, because the view from the top will make it all worth it eventually. And actually, that is why we're so interested, aren't we, I think, in the testimonies of those who've been to the top of our particular hill to see if the hype is really real. And so we tune in to people like, you know, the Bill Gateses or the Mark Zuckerbergs or the lottery winner or the celebrity or the friend who's achieved partner in the firm. What's it like? Is the view really worth the climb, we want to ask? And sometimes the people who have got to the top of that hill are quite honest. And they say, well, actually, no, it wasn't what I was expecting. The view wasn't quite what I'd hoped. I really enjoyed the Gavin Peacock event at the Barge. I went to the lunchtime one, some of you will have been to that, or to the evening one. And if you were at it, he's a Premiership footballer, and he said something very similar to this. He achieved his goal pretty early in life, being a professional footballer, I think age 16, and he just discovered very early that it was a massive anticlimax. He got to the top, and he just found it very pressurised and very insecure. He had a high on a Saturday and then an injury on a Wednesday, and it was just an awful life. And sometimes these people have got to the top and they've achieved that goal, they conclude, well, maybe I just haven't got higher enough. And you can imagine Gavin Peacock saying, well, maybe it's because I'm only in the Premiership. I need to play for my country, or, you know, the next stage, the next stage. Or sometimes people get to that stage and they think, well, maybe this wasn't the right hill and I just need to pick another one. Relationships or whatever it is. And yet, very, very occasionally, you find human beings who have sufficient ability and wealth and drive to make it their life's work to climb all of the hills that you can imagine. And they set out to discover conclusively what really is worthwhile, what is purposeful, what is lasting in this life. And that's what we're looking at today. The writer of Ecclesiastes, he was uniquely qualified for this investigation, as we're going to see. And he did it really carefully and thoroughly and reliably. And it's brilliant for us to read it, because for all the rest of us who are still climbing up the slopes, he puts us out of our misery. And he tells us that we can take his word for it and not live in a delusion, trying the next slope, the next slope. And Solomon gives his conclusion up front in chapter 1, and it's in two stages. I've put there claim number 1 on the sheets: God has frustrated this life. And claim 2, and even wisdom can't bring ultimate gain. And then he follows through with the evidence for his two claims in chapter 2. So we're going to do that. That's the structure, if you can get your head around it. It's kind of A, B, A, B, and we're going to work through it in that order. So let's look at claim number 1. God has frustrated this life. Chapter 1, verse 12. I, the preacher, have been king over Israel in Jerusalem, and I applied my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. It's quite a big ambition. Solomon, this guy, he didn't waste the wisdom that God gave him. If you know in the Bible, God gave this guy, Solomon, particular wisdom. And he had this gift and he wanted to make use of it. And he set himself the highest challenge imaginable. He wanted to gain a theory of everything. He wanted to discover all that is done under heaven. Here's his conclusion. It is an unhappy business, verse 13, that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. I've seen everything that is done under the sun, and behold, all is vapour and a striving after wind. And then he ends with a proverb. If you know anything about Solomon, you'll know he's a big fan of proverbs. Verse 15, what is crooked cannot be made straight. What is lacking cannot be counted. And if we were to read on to chapter 7:13, it would make it clear that it is God who has made this world crooked. He's the one who's made it lacking. Solomon's claim is, as our heading says, it's God who has frustrated this life. Now, I don't know about you, perhaps when you hear that, you think that kind of language, you think that's very odd. Why would God do that? Why would God be so negative? Why would God deliberately make things hard? It's worth saying there is a form of Christianity around which has as its starting position that if I'm going to believe in a God, it must be a God who wants to give me a nice life. And then everything seems to be reasoned from that starting position. And you'll have heard this around the place. For example, God must want me to be sexually fulfilled. Therefore, we have to change the Bible's teaching on sexuality where I don't agree with it, or so on. But the God of the Bible, thankfully, is not an indulgent parent. He's not a parent who just endorses whatever his children want, whether it's good for them or not. No. The God of the universe is a loving parent, and he's one who teaches that actions have consequences. And when the first human beings rebelled, he disciplined them, and he cursed this whole earth. Not forever, but until a saviour could come and find a way to forgive and reconcile the rebels, before ultimately setting the whole creation free again from its bondage to corruption, as the New Testament tells us. In our house, we're big fans of the David Attenborough documentaries, and David Attenborough has said that he cannot believe in God because why would God create a world in which there are parasitic worms which make people blind? You may have heard that kind of objection. Stephen Fry makes almost exactly the same point, the same argument, from bone cancer in children. Why would God do that? He can't exist. Now, of course, if we believe in the God whose great aim in life is to give me a nice life, then those are good objections. They're powerful objections. Yes, why isn't the world better? He's not doing it very well. But of course, the Bible speaks not only of a world created perfectly good, but crucially, and this is the ABC, this is right at the beginning of the Bible story, but crucially also of a world which is under God's curse. A world where we expect thorns and thistles. A world in which parasitic worms and bone cancer and futility and frustration are exactly what the Bible tells us to expect in this age. But surely, we say, if we follow God's pattern, if I do what is right, if I try and live wisely, then surely life should go well, shouldn't it? Surely I will be able to break free from this futility, this brokenness, wouldn't I? And that brings us on to Solomon's second claim there, chapter 1, 16 to 18. Even wisdom can't bring ultimate gain. Look at verse 16. I said in my heart, I have acquired great wisdom, surpassing all who were over Jerusalem before me. And my heart has had great experience of wisdom and knowledge, and I applied my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. Surely if anyone can tell us about the ultimate benefits of a wise life, it is this guy. And what is his conclusion, verse 17? I perceive that this also is but a striving after wind. In fact, Solomon says wisdom can actually make life worse. And he finishes with another proverb, verse 18. For in much wisdom is much vexation, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. And we'll see later that was precisely Solomon's experience. So there's his heading right up front. This is a frustrated world. God has deliberately frustrated this life. Even wisdom can't bring us ultimate gain. And now we're going to get on to chapter 2, and Solomon is going to present his arguments for what he's discovered. Now, to prove his point that about Solomon sets about climbing now every conceivable hill that humans think might bring gain in this life, every hill that which might make life ultimately worthwhile. And that's what we're going to read. Chapter 2, verse 1. I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. But behold, this also was vanity. I said of laughter, it is mad. And of pleasure, what use is it? I search with my heart how to cheer my body with wine. It's important to see here that he didn't temporarily become a complete fool and go on a road trip with his drinking buddies. This isn't kind of Solomon abandoning reason. Throughout the whole exercise, he says, my heart, this is verse 3, my heart still guiding me with wisdom and how to lay hold on folly. So he was testing out folly as well as part of his investigation. He goes on, till I might see what was good for the children of man to do under heaven during the few days of their life. So he tried pleasure, he tried comedy, he tried amusement, he tried drinking, but he realised none of it was really delivering. What did he do next? Look at verse 4. I made great works. I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. I made myself gardens and parks and planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made myself pools from which to water the forest of growing trees. And that word for parks there in verse 5 is the word from which we get our word paradise. And that's deliberate. It's The point is that this description here is deliberately Eden-like. Did you notice it as we read? It's filled with trees, it's watered by pools. And the point is that Solomon is trying to build Eden here, trying to build heaven here. And actually, he got closer to it than anyone else is going to get. And he left nothing out of his investigations. And what was his conclusion, verse 11? Then I considered all that my hands had done and the toil I'd expended in doing it, and behold, all was vapour and a striving after wind. And here's the key phrase, and there was nothing to be gained under the sun. God has so frustrated this life that there is no pursuit which is ultimately worthwhile and purposeful and lasting in this life. And this Eden language, this idea of trying to build heaven here, is very revealing and actually transfers very easily into our situation. How many of the people around us, how many of us, are basically living life trying to build heaven here? It's just around the corner. If I can just finish my training, if I can just find a partner, if I can just start a family, if I can just get the baby to sleep through, if I can just get them into school, get them through uni, if I can just get that house in the suburbs, if I can just get that promotion, then, we say, then life will be good. And Solomon says to us, look, I have been right to the top and they are lying to you. Take realistically what this world is like. You cannot build heaven here. It is not going to deliver what it promises. And particularly for you and for me, we need to realise that we are not wiser than Solomon on this one. Let him teach us. And it's not simply that we need to learn some secret or need to learn to live a more upright life to invite the blessing in. Because even wisdom can't bring that ultimate gain. Look at verse 14. The wise person has his eyes in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. So he's saying wisdom is wonderful, but however wonderful it is, it cannot bring ultimate gain. End of 14. Yet I perceive that the same event happens to all of them. And you know what he's talking about there. He's talking about death. One of the most memorable parts for me of being a first year medical student back in the dissection room was these. So you had these corpses laid out on rows of tables, four students per corpse, and you may be able to tell. You try and project a story onto your particular cadaver, and you try and imagine what their life was like. And there are some clues. There's a few things, like, you know, you might tell if they're a smoker, or you could tell what their drinking habits were. But at the end of the day, you really can't tell much. And whether they were wise or foolish in their lives, whether they were postmen or prime ministers, the point is when they are laid out slabs of meat like that, they all look very much the same. Death is the great leveller. In some ways, this guy, Leo Tolstoy, the Russian novelist and aristocrat, he was a little bit like the Solomon of his day. And he too thought he would do this theory of everything, this quest to discover what life was really all about. And he decided he would go all out after pleasure. And at university, he drank heavily, he lived promiscuously, he gambled, and he discovered pretty quickly that it was all empty. Then he decided to pursue relationships, and he married a loving wife. He had 13 children. So you can kind of get the character of the guy. Nothing he did by halves. But again, it didn't fulfill in the way that he had hoped. He found it was empty. So he decided to go hard after wealth and after fame. And so what did he do? He wrote War and Peace. Which most of us would think would be an achievement to read, but he actually wrote it. And Tolstoy, you'll know, he wrote some of the finest works of literature that there are in any language. And through it all, he said there was one question which haunted him to the verge of suicide. And that question was this: is there any meaning in my life that the inevitable death awaiting me does not destroy? That is what Solomon discovered much earlier. Tolstoy realizing here that however wise, however foolish he could be, ultimately it was all irrelevant. None of it could make any difference in the face of death. Solomon wants us to dwell on that and to let it sink in. And having established his case that God really has frustrated this life and that even wisdom cannot bring ultimate gain, he now opens up a wonderfully positive message of how it is that we are to live wisely in such a world as this. And here it is, the positive message at the bottom. Life is actually about gifts more than gain. Let's look at verse 22. What has a man from all the toil and striving of heart with which he toils beneath the sun? Almost the same question that he began with back in chapter 1, verse 3. Where's the gain? Where's the gain? But now he shows what kind of a life comes from being obsessed with that question. Verse 23. For all his days are full of sorrow, and his work is a vexation. And now there's some additional evidence that this is an unhealthy question to be obsessed with. Even in the night, his heart does not rest. That is a mark in the Bible of the ungodly person in Psalm 127. That unable to rest at night. This also is vapour. So Solomon has discovered that being obsessed with this question of where's the gain, where's the gain, is the tried and tested route, he says, to a stressed out and ultimately insubstantial, vaporous life. That is not the route to go down. There is a better way. Have a look at verse 24. There is nothing better for a person than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. This also, I saw, is from the hand of God. For apart from him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? And this actually is one of the big messages to us from the whole book. In fact, arguably, it's how Solomon closes each of his sections. You get it here, again in chapter 5, again in chapter 8, again in chapter 12. And the point is that he wants us not simply to redirect where we might find gain. He is going to do that, by the way. He's going to encourage us to entrust gain to God, and in particular to God's final evaluation of us. He will do that, and that's how the book closes. But especially here, he wants to challenge our whole outlook. And so instead of getting to the end of each day and asking ourselves, well, what have I achieved? What have I achieved today? Where's the gain? He wants us to reorient ourselves and to get to the end of our day and say, well, what have I received today? What have I received? And learning this from Ecclesiastes, bit by bit over the last couple of years, this has been a big paradigm shift for me, and I hope it will be for some of you if this isn't something you've thought of much before. Solomon here is inviting us to reflect upon, what if life wasn't a computer game about achieving the most gain before the time runs out? What if rather life, as God has created it, is an arena, a theatre in which we as creatures get to receive good gifts from a loving creator, ultimately so that we can know him and enjoy him better through his gifts? Two very different ways of looking at the world. Since I started to discover this teaching from Ecclesiastes over the last couple of years, I've tried to think about my day differently. Ordinarily in the evening, Jason and I have a conversation, goes something like this: how was your day, Andrew? And I then try and run through in my head how many of my goals I'd fulfilled, and I run through in my head and I think, well, and then I give an answer. This is how much gain I have achieved. And Solomon is saying a much more helpful way to think about our days is this, to run through in your head, well, what gifts have you received from the Lord today? Yesterday has had some real challenges, it's had some frustrations, as it would in the world that's been cursed. But there are plenty of things still to be thankful for. And God has shown his kindness in all kinds of ways, even amidst the frustrations. Let me give you three. That's a great way to answer if someone says, how was your day? One of the things we do with the children at tea time, we play highs and lows, where they have to say the best thing and the worst thing about their day. And then the idea is, it doesn't happen as much as it should, but to try and convert the highs then into prayers of thanks later on in the evening. I'm actually quite nervous about sharing this sort of thing because it gives the impression, and especially if you don't know me, that we have a perfect, blissful family life, and we really don't. It is mainly chaos. But we do have this aspiration that this is what we want to be doing, even if we don't hit it much of the time. To be asking not just, you know, as the children come in, how was the spelling test? How did it go? What was gained? But to be asking, what was there to thank God for today? Maybe that's something that we could be bringing into family life. I'm not always a fan of Richard Curtis films, but one I do really like is About Time, made in 2013. And if you've seen it, it's about a father and a son, and they can time travel back to earlier points in their own lives. And there's one point where the father, Bill Nighy, gives his son, played by Donald Gleeson, this advice. And he says this: live each day twice. They can time travel, so they can do that. Live each day twice. The first time, live it as normal, with all the tensions and worries. But the second time, live it almost exactly the same, but this time, free to notice and enjoy how sweet the world can be. And after that advice, in the film, you then get to watch the same scene twice. And it's of the son rushing, he's a barrister, he's rushing to court to present his case. But the second time you see this scene, he does the same thing, but he notices various things. He notices that the birds were singing, and he notices how majestic the buildings are around the courtroom. And all this stuff that he'd missed the first time because he was rushing and he was stressed. And before long, the son in this film, he learns the trick of only having to live every day once. Because by living every day twice, he's learnt this skill of appreciating everything as if he were living it for the second time. And I think the preacher here, Solomon, I think he would thoroughly approve of that message. He would say, learn to live each day, not obsessed with where's the gain, what have I achieved, but learn to live each day noticing and crucially, thanking God for, which wasn't majored on in the film, every gift that he gives us. I'm guessing this will be raising a whole load of questions for us. I think that's one of the brilliant things about A Weekend Away, isn't it? Is that we have space and time to chat and to bring questions. And I think we're going to have Q&A in these sessions as well. But I want to spend the remaining couple of minutes just thinking about how this teaching in Ecclesiastes might fit with the rest of the Bible's teaching. And specifically after that, what, if anything, changes when it gets through to the New Testament? So first, how does this fit in generally with the Bible's teaching? Well, one reason that I put on the sheets there, life's about gifts more than gain, rather than life's about gifts, not gain, is because there is a right place for pursuing gain. There is a right pursuing of profit and achievement. But it's relativized. It's not everything. When God gave humanity a work to do, which he did at the beginning when he told the first man, Adam, to cultivate the garden, if you look at the chapter, it wasn't an end in itself. It's not as if God needed his produce and Adam was just a unit of productivity, you know, placed in the factory to get on with the task. No, Adam's work was always placed within the bigger context of Adam's relationship with his creator. Work is not the only thing in Adam's life. He's got a beautiful, fruitful garden to enjoy. He's got a wife. He's got a loving creator to walk with in the cool of the day. But of course, since God himself is a worker, he's introduced in Genesis 1 as the one who accomplishes tasks and then enjoys the fruit of them. Naturally, Adam learns to relate to God by joining God in his work. It's a little bit like the toddler who helps their daddy in the kitchen or helps their daddy with some DIY. It's not strictly because the dad needs the help, and I can testify to that. But the point is that the DIY or the cooking or whatever situation they're helping with, that is the situation in which the toddler gets to hang out with and gets to know their father. And in which actually the toddler learns to be like their father. So imagine for a moment a father. Sorry, that was meant to be the image to say life is about gifts more than gain. But imagine now a father. Here's a picture I had of a father who takes his daughters out to build sandcastles on the beach, which in my opinion is not just a great way to spend a day, it is a great way to spend a fortnight. It's a great pursuit. Now, if the child approaches that task entirely from a gain mentality, imagine the child who has been educated with all the air that we breathe. What matters is gain, gain, gain. And imagine that child ignores the context of relationship, and they ignore the context of joy and of receiving and learning from and growing like their parent. Well, that two things are very likely to happen to that child. First, the child will quickly get stressed. If the only thing that matters that day is gain, 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 then if they're not hitting their targets, or if the sandcastle isn't quite how they wanted it, then that is a disaster. That is a wasted day. And second, when later on the inevitable does happen and the tide, as it always will, washes their project away, that child is going to be devastated. Either they will give up on building sandcastles all together and try and find a better pursuit, or they'll obsess about how next time they're going to make sure their work is slightly more tide resistant, or whatever it is. But of course, if the child understands that the whole task is in the context of something much bigger, something much more important, their relationship with their father, then of course they'll still want to make the best sandcastle they've ever made. Of course they will. They want to grow. They want to learn to use their creativity to the limit. But then if it doesn't work out quite right, or if later the tide does flatten it, well, that's going to be disappointing, of course, but it won't be devastating. After all, life is about gifts more than it's about gain. And they still got to spend the day with their father. And best of all, he was pleased with what they made, and that's what counts. I hope you can see the analogy I'm working towards. What about if our work wasn't about gain, gain, gain? What if it was in a bigger context? A way to learn to be like our Father, to enjoy him and his gifts. Well, what about this second question? What if anything of this changes when we get through to the New Testament? Well, actually, I think there are some changes when we get to the New Testament about this topic of futility. But this, at least, stays the same. This title I put, life is still about gifts more than it's about gain. So the labour that we do, even labour in the Lord, as we discover in the New Testament, this great privilege New Testament believers have of cooperating with God's great building project, of building a people for himself, the one sandcastle, we're told, which will survive the tide coming up. Even that is still not ultimate. Think about it. God does not need our efforts, does he? Any way that you and I get to partner with God in his gospel work, it's like toddlers helping with the DIY. It's not because God needs it. It's all for our benefit. We're not units of productivity. We are children who are getting to join in with our Father's project and learning to love what he loves and to become like him. And the New Testament still calls us to enjoy with thankfulness God's good gifts to us each day, acknowledging the God who richly provides us with everything to enjoy, as Paul puts it in 1 Timothy 6. These things continue through into the New Testament, enjoying the good gifts of life. So as we close now, if we are believers here today, some of us may remember that moment when we first discovered that our salvation is all of grace, all of God's kindness, when we discovered it was sheer gift. And if we talked about this afterwards, there'd be stories amongst us of that moment of realization and how freeing and beautiful it was. Well, how wonderful to discover that God, our Creator, has the same way of operating as God, our Saviour. And that even our day-to-day lives of working and eating and sleeping are first and foremost, just like in salvation, they're first and foremost an arena for grace. They're a place where our Creator God gives us gifts and where we learn to receive God's gifts in thankful dependence on him.